Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Eric Jensen. Eric is over 20 years of experience as a product management and sales executive in the high technology industry. He was CEO of two venture-backed companies, managing director of a seed stage investment firm that enjoyed six liquidity events, including two IPOs and four sales to Cisco, Microsoft, Nortel, and EMC. He founded iTulip.com in 1998 and is the president of iTulip, Inc. since 2006. Eric authored the book, The Post-Catastrophe Economy, in 2010. He speaks at a wide range of investor conferences from MIT and Stanford to Hard Assets, New York City, and Vegas. Eric, welcome back to our show.
Great to be here, Bruce.
Since the book in 2010, how have the last 5 years played out differently than you thought they might?
Well, not terribly differently. I do think that the Fed and central banks generally have become more activist even than I thought. Back before the crisis, those of us who thought there was something that was going to happen, that we're going to have some sort of a crash, took two sides, a deflationist side and an inflationist side. And my view had always been that we were not going to have a prolonged period of deflation, that it would be the economy after the crisis would be reflated. And I proposed that the Fed would do a lot of unorthodox things to cause that to happen. But I think even I underestimated the extent to which they were willing to kind of cross the line into an area of market activism that I think will turn out to be imprudent.
Well, I guess that's the point. It seems like we've made progress. You know, if you look at some charts, you can say, okay, well, certainly unemployment's improved. Asset prices have improved and so forth. So I guess the question is the progress real, or are we going to have we just delayed something that is inevitable?
Yeah, I think that's the question that everybody is asking, is this economy running on stimulus, or is it running on its own fuel? Is the private sector actually improved enough that it's self-sustaining and the Fed can begin to withdraw stimulus? I think that evidence that they can it comes in the form of the withdrawal of fiscal stimulus long ago. If you look at the way that some years ago there's some concern about budget deficits, you don't hear that much anymore because deficits have actually been declining very quickly as the economy grows, because outlays have been pretty much flat as the economy has recovered. So, there's evidence that the Fed's tapering in the measure that it's doing it may actually achieve the objective, which is to meet economic growth somewhere in the middle of the year and allow the self-reinforcing growth in the private sector take over from where the fiscal and monetary stimulus left off.
What's interesting is, there was this, and I remember exactly what the timing was, but there was almost a reaction on a rumor that they were going to taper. And I remember 10-year T-bills just shooting to three plus, maybe 3.25. And today it's 1.98.
Mm-hmm.
And, what do you make of something like that? Is that a statement of that the economy is really less than it appears, or what does that mean?
Well, this is what I meant by the Fed taking steps that even I thought were beyond what I was expecting, and I refer to these yield curve shaping and other phrases that the Fed uses as bond price fixing, which effectively is what it is. And they're doing it on the short end per the Fed's charter, where they're restricted to only change, modify the value of the short end of the yield curve with 6 months treasuries and 6 month duration government notes, and that's it. That's all they're allowed to use. And now, of course, they've been buying, you know, mortgage bonds or long bonds and so forth. You know, the trouble with that is that it's very difficult for the bond market to understand, after that's gone on for a while, what the actual market price of a bond is, because demand, supply and demand has been perturbed by you know, Fed involvement. So, you know, I think that every time they do something, the market would necessarily go through a period of dislocation as it tries to figure out what is the real supply demand dynamic within the bond market without the participation of the central bank, whose balance sheet is in theory infinite, and proposes a unmeasurable impact on the supply demand picture.
When I first got into the real estate business, approximately in 1981, the Fed fund rate changed 21 times that year, both up and down.
Yeah.
And now it hasn't changed in 6 years. And I think there's a lot of complacency about lack of volatility. And that, at some point, will not be the norm. It will change.
Well, we've gotten, you know, several warnings from Yellen, and even, you know, Greenspan has come out of retirement on occasion to warn that when the Fed finally does raise rates, clearly there's going to be some period of dislocation in the markets. It's just not really understood what it's going to be. I happened to be at a meeting at the Boston Fed when Janet Yellen gave a speech back in June of 2012. I got to ask her a couple of questions in public, which you can find a link to someplace on Vimeo or something. But also afterwards, I got to speak with her for a good 10 minutes afterwards. I think nobody at the time realized she was going to be our next chairman, so nobody thought to walk up and talk to her. But now, I asked her a few questions about how the Fed would go about making its decisions sometime off in the future. Her presentation was about that, really. It was about how sometime in the year 2015, the Fed would very likely be raising rates, and you know, here are the models that they would be using, and here's the decision criteria, and you know, going back to rules-based versus seat-of-the-pants decision-making. Would you know, cause them to make these kinds of decisions. I remember thinking at the time when she put that chart up there and it showed, you know, a time in the future and it had, you know, indications of rate hikes via three different scenarios, that the market would hold her to it. I mean, once you know, the vice chairman of the Fed puts a chart like that up there, it kind of says you got to do it. Mm-hmm. Either that or you have to make a very strong argument that none of the criteria that you put forward then have been met. So, you know, I think that they know at some level that when they do raise rates, that the economy is going to, the markets are going to overreact, and it could potentially cause problems with the real economy as well. So my theory is that they're going to wait to do that until there's a substantial amount of momentum already in the economy, until it almost feels like it's they're behind the curve. And you hear a lot of talk about them being behind the curve, and the Fed will come under some pressure for being too slow to make a decision. But I think that's, you know, latter part of this year. But the concern that they're going to raise rates, you know, in middle of the year, which seems to be what the market thinks, I think is inaccurate.
What do you think of the value of the dollar and the ramifications that it has being as strong as it is?
Well, you know, you've probably heard the term currency wars. I'm not a fan of that concept, because I think the central banks are extremely cooperative, and I think a more accurate description is a merry-go-round, where they take turns depreciating currencies in order to stimulate economies. We went first, of course, because if the U.S. is in trouble, then everybody's in trouble. So we depreciated the dollar heavily back in 2009, and that helped stimulate some inflation and export growth. Subsequently, it was Japan's turn. Seemed to work pretty well. They got some inflation going, although they also gave themselves a recession. Now it's Europe's turn. You can see that the euro is it's almost at a parity with the dollar now. And sooner or later, once they're on their feet, it'll be our turn again. So, I think that a strong dollar will be here, for another, 6 to 9 months, and then it'll be it'll start to weaken again.
The price of oil, that's, it's interesting. I'm sure there's lots of consultants out there. I don't know if anybody in writing had said, you know what, this is probably going to drop by half in the next 6 months. Anybody see that coming? And again, what caused that? And is that something that's going to change abruptly and go the other way?
Well, I have to say, I certainly didn't anticipate that. But one of the ITOC members, who's an expert in the energy industry, did tell us early part of the year that this was going to happen. And even, although it did happen to a greater extent than he expected, his argument was that the U.S. was simply overproducing oil, and that we had, for a number of reasons, largely political, but also economic, had embarked on a program of going after oil when the price was high, and everyone kind of piled into it, and it became very lucrative for a while. But necessarily, that produced a glut. The Saudis have responded to it as well. So it's not purely a matter of supply and demand. It's also, one of the other factors is that the Saudis want to reassert their role as a swing producer and make their case and keep the price there until they get what they're trying to achieve, which is, lower U.S. Production.
Mm-hmm.
And, so the numbers I'm hearing are, the bottom is somewhere between 35 and 40. That's what most of the large energy companies are anticipating in their budgeting process. They don't expect it to stay there for more than, I think the general theory is 6 to 9 months and then starts to rise again. But I think that this, there's a lot of speculation about the impact that has on the U.S. economy, and obviously it's not good for employment incomes and housing in the patch, in the oil patch. But, of course, it's quite stimulative to the rest of the economy because it's reducing input costs for producers and freeing up disposable income for consumers.
We've had volatile shifts before. As a matter of fact, one of the first major purchases I ever made was in Grand Junction, Colorado, courtesy of the oil price crash that came around 82, something like that.
Sure.
And that sort of felt like the same reasoning. Okay, we're trying to get oil shale up and going, and the price drops out of the sky, and they close up Rifle because it's not profitable. So, is that the gist of what's going on? Is trying to curtail the production because it's just no longer profitable to pursue it?
Well, the old timers who lived through this in several cycles, say in Texas, for example, and it was very painful and. You had, rows of unfinished homes foundations in the ground and all that kind of stuff. It was a very, very long road for recovery back in the 80s when that oil price crash occurred. Of course, that oil price crash was engineered by our central bank to try to kill not targeting oil specifically, but inflation. But, in this case, if you look at the prices of other commodities, let's say nickel and aluminum, and zinc, and commodity metals, for example, those prices are either flat or up for the year. In fact, 2014 was a much better year than 2013, when prices were generally down.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't really a question of commodities. It is an oil question, and is oil the most political of commodities is being affected.
In the oil industry, this technology of fracking is now, it seems to be, although it's being challenged like in places like New York, it seems to be an acceptable means of extracting something that's new. We can't possibly be the only country that has potential for that. So I guess is the long-term supply likely to grow as faster than the demand?
Well, Bruce, fracking was first invented in the 1930s. It was refined somewhat in the 1980s, but didn't really become economical until the oil price went up to, $67, $80. And that's when the process of really building out and the investment in these projects got going. And as the price continued to go up, of course, more projects were charted at higher prices. And so, you know, that'll all reverse. So the guys who got in late will be the first guys out because they'll have the least economical project. But the difference between, I think, this cycle, at least what I've been told, I'm not an expert in oil, but we have a number that are in our group, is that the difference is that in a conventional oil field, if the price crashes and you got to shut it down, you actually can damage the field. It's actually bad long term production. But that's not actually the true in the case of fracking and in unconventional extraction, where you can shut things down and it actually improves the long term viability of the field. So I think that the ability to shut these things down and then bring them back online later, I think will considerably ease the pain that I think a lot of people are expecting, who are in particular the old timers who remember the bad old days when this has happened before. I think it's going to be that the industry is more adaptable and more malleable and more able to absorb this, and provided, of course, it doesn't drag on for years.
In the post-catastrophe economy, you referenced the way we had kind of orchestrated things was under a fire economy, finance, insurance, and real estate. Is that still alive and well, and is that how we still are pursuing the future?
Well, the housing industry remains about 20% of GDP, and the answer is the real estate portion of fire is still a major part of the economy. Of course, it operates differently today than it did before the crisis. Fannie and Freddie that buy 90% of the loans in the secondary market are now public companies, right? They're government owned entities. So the structure of the market is different today. Wall Street will never be what it was. Of course, I think it will. It's still kind of an echo of what it was. I think the really positive development that I've seen, particularly over the last few years, is in the area of what I refer to as the techie economy, the technology economy. And you can start to see it everywhere. One of the things I talked about in the book, this is a number of years ago, that we'd start to see, for example, LED lighting come drastically down in price. And we start to see substitution of light emitting diode lighting for incandescent lighting. This would have a pretty big impact on electricity demand. And here we are 5 years later, and I was actually just at the local IKEA buying 60-watt equivalent bulbs for $3, and those were $30 five years ago. There's a lot of really good stuff happening on the technology front that is going to impact the economy in a positive way.
How's our manufacturing sector, and is there any likelihood that we'll be regaining some of those entire industries that we now do nothing in?
Well, it's interesting, Bruce. That one of the things that's happened, particularly related to the oil industry or the energy industry, is that there's a kind of a misnomer. The U.S. doesn't export anything. The U.S. exports trillions of dollars worth of goods every year. But what has changed is the composition of that. I'll just name off a couple of things. Back in 2004, for example, our top exports were semiconductors, aircraft, parts for cars, computers, various kinds of industrial machines, pharmaceuticals, and cars, telecommunications equipment. And those are kind of our top exports. Now, that was in 2004. Fast forward 10 years, and our biggest export is, this is in dollar volume, by the way, is aircraft, and number two is fuel oil, of all things.
Yeah.
Petroleum products is number three, right? So passenger cars are still on there, industrial machines and so forth. But the big change is that we started producing a lot of oil. We didn't ship crude oil, but we shipped a lot of distillates and a lot of refined products. And that became, you know, used to be a de minimis part of our export volume, but then became a very large part of it. So it's not just too surprising that the Saudis observing this decided that the old Saudi Arabia is the new Saudi Arabia, and they weren't too keen on us being the new Saudi Arabia.
Okay. What do you see in the next couple of years? Take it out as far as you want. Do you feel comfortable with how things are going to turn out, or is there concerns?
Well, I think, you know, Bruce, I think this year is going to be kind of a boom year. I think that might surprise some people that the Fed knows that when it acts, that there'll be problems, that there's going to be, they could very well induce, if not a recession, enough of a contraction in growth to potentially cause a recession. So the analogy I like to use is if you know you're going to take some sort of action that's going to cause your airplane to lose 10,000 feet of altitude, you don't want to do that from 10,000 feet. You want to do that from 20 or 30,000. So they're going to wait until the aircraft, the economy gets enough altitude before it starts to do anything that could potentially cause a downturn or cause a disproportionate reaction in the markets to whatever they do.
Okay, that makes sense. Are you confident about the future? I know that was always your intent when you wrote the book. You were kind of making a plan, saying, you know what, we got to remember who we are. We're really brilliant when the chips are down, and we have a lot of things that at our disposal, the freedom and so forth to be creative. And that's the America you wanted to see show up again. So have we implemented that sufficiently to, you know, have a bright future again?
Well, you know, you can go broke short in the United States of America. I mean, if you look around, you know, we got our problems. We do tend to do things to excess, as has occurred in the stock market and in the market for mortgage securities. So we get ourselves into trouble that way. But if you look at other countries, look around Europe, look around Asia, you still can't find a country that is as big and is as good at self-correcting as we are. Our system is just very, it's very adaptable and very, very good at adjusting for change. One of our strengths is that we're not sentimental and we're not conservative. We're not trying to stay the way we were. And other countries are probably devoted to that prospect.
Mm-hmm.
So it would give us a lot of resilience. And so I think the United States is going to continue to do well.
Have any plans for another book?
Well, I'm working on a couple of projects, but in the area of startups. I do have a couple of friends who have been urging me to write a book about China for a while.
Okay.
And the reason being, I think that China is vastly misunderstood by most people. It'd be kind of fun to write about it. I think most Americans think China is like a giant United States full of Chinese people. My wife is Chinese, by the way. You met her. And that's just really not the case. It's just a completely different kind of animal. And in some ways, it's very inspiring. In other ways, it's very scary, particularly because of its governance structure, which is quite brittle. And if things go wrong there, it's very difficult to predict what they'll do.
Okay. Eric, we've run out of time. I encourage everybody to go to his website, itulip.com. A lot of not only brilliant commentary from Eric, but also he has quite a following, and they're pretty smart, too. Eric, thanks so much for taking time to join us today, okay?
Hey, Bruce, my pleasure. Anytime.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.